Welcome to Panic Mode, the podcast for gamers and game designers with your hosts, the people with the purple hair.
Shubby Nate.
That's us.
Purple hair, huh?
Oh, yeah.
I guess no one can refute that.
No, it's true. They still can't see us, and it's great.
I mean, our logo's kind of purple, so they have no reason not to believe that.
That's true. We could very much have purple hair right now. And yes, it does look awesome.
Anyway, we're on episode 4 now, and the subject for today's episode is narrative design.
Yes.
Oh, boy. This is a topic.
Narrative design is a huge topic, not only in terms of writing, but as well in terms of video games, which is what we're going to be solely focusing on today. We recognize that stories are told in all kinds of gaming, from board games to D&D tabletop games, Dungeons and Dragons, but today it's solely going to be video games. We may focus on those things at other times, but
in the interest of taking this monumental subject and biting off a relatively bite-sized piece, just video games for now.
Yes. So, let's get started.
All right, Shelby, here's an easy question. As someone who specializes in narrative design, what works for narrative design in video games?
So let's start this off real general, really broad. Usually what you look for in a narrative or a story is having meaningful characters with meaningful interactions with the world around them or with others. You usually want to try avoiding stereotypes of characters unless you're trying to make a statement. So things like the dumb blonde or the super sporty jock guy.
or the retiring cop who talks like this. It's like, I'm not able to do this anymore.
Exactly. It's usually good to have well-rounded characters who are interesting for the players to interact with, even if they don't like them. You don't have to make likable characters, you just have to make interesting ones.
Easy. That easy. Episode done.
Waboosh. Yeah, all right. See you next week, guys. Generally, there's also a character with a goal and then an obstacle to keep that character from reaching it. So this is usually how conflict happens. So just for a quick example, in The Witcher 3, Geralt, the title character, wants to find his adoptive daughter, Ciri. That is his goal. And when he goes out to look for her, he encounters a bunch of obstacles that prevent him from reaching this goal.
A lot of fetch quests, too.
A lot of fetch quests. Good fetch quests, keep in mind.
You gotta find that
pan. And this creates conflict for the game to occur. So that's very broadly speaking. We also want to quickly acknowledge what is called the hero's journey. Some of you may have heard of this. It is most known in the film Star Wars, where there's something like a call to adventure, there's a reward, there's some mentors, there's a return home. Basically, it is what is most notably the structure of a story from beginning to end. But the reason we're not going to talk about it a lot is because it's extremely broad, and I argue personally that you could paste the hero's journey, or at least parts of it, onto every single story in existence. And so we're not going to really talk about it today.
Now, not to discredit your answer or anything, but you what you just described kind of goes for anything that you could learn in an English class or a writing class.
Oh, absolutely.
And it doesn't actually pertain to video games very well. So I feel like I'm actually asking the wrong question.
Yeah, you could totally apply this character stuff to just a novel or a film.
So I suppose the real question we should try to get to is, what is the difference between narrative and video games versus other mediums?
That is a great question, Ian.
And a little bit more nuanced to answer. So if I had to sum that question up, the answer to that question up in one word, I would say video games are interactive.
Interactive. That's a good word. I would agree.
This can manifest itself in a few ways. I think one of the most interesting ones is that the mechanics and the gameplay will often take precedence over the narrative. There will be long stretches where the player is not interacting with the narrative. And they're just dealing with the gameplay. And you have to realize that, unlike a book where the reader is just entirely engaged without your writing, player is not always looking at the narrative.
So when we say interactivity, there is a huge difference between reading a book and playing a game where you are controlling a character. You don't control characters in a book, you just kind of read what they're doing. But in a video game, you can very much choose where Nathan Drake decides to go in Uncharted, even if his story is very much a linear one. So what happens with this interactivity is that oftentimes, and this isn't speaking for all video games, but in a lot of video games, like Uncharted, for example, there will be huge breaks between the narrative and when you're actually playing the game. So there could be a cutscene, and then you're launched into some gameplay for, I don't know, anywhere from half an hour to a couple of hours, depending on maybe the difficulty level and your competency as a player, before you actually get the next narrative piece. So these are all things to keep in mind for when you're crafting a narrative within a game and having it all make sense to the player without having them get bored of either the narrative or the gameplay.
But this could obviously differ dramatically from game to game, because, like you mentioned, Uncharted is almost like a screenplay at times.
Yes, very much so.
Where I'm pretty sure they sit down and they just write scripts, and they shoot the scenes in mocap, and off you go. Then consider a game like Dark Souls, which I would love to know what the narrative designers looked like for Dark Souls.
Yes, that would be very interesting.
You had to sculpt this cohesive world without an actual plot or a script to it.
Yeah, very much so. There's also the game that I like to cite a lot is Gone Home. It's basically a 4 or 5 hour experience, and it's just about a girl walking through her abandoned house, wondering kind of what the story is there. And there's very little gameplay in terms of exciting things happening, like shooting or running or jumping or hiding or stealth or anything like that. It's just a story being delivered as you walk through this house. And I think that's a great example of how narrative can succeed in games, and also an example of how a narrative doesn't necessarily need to be pasted on top of an explosive action shooter or anything like that. You can really do whatever you want.
No. And I think what you just described there, pasting a narrative on top of another game, mm-hmm. is really not what you want to do.
No.
And ideally you want it to kind of be a cohesive link between the gameplay and the narrative.
Yeah. So this is also, I think, aside from video games being interactive and making them different from other media, this is kind of the most important point that we want to stress when it comes to video games versus other media. It's when you're crafting a video game story, it can't just be the narrative. It has to be a marriage, if you will, of narrative and gameplay. So this is kind of the biggest point. It's not just about writing a story, it's about taking into account all of these other things that video games offer, like sound design and animation and the way your character looks and moves and feels and the mechanics of the game. So imagine a game like Dark Souls, where the goal of the story of Dark Souls is to kind of, at least one of the goals of the game is to make you feel very isolated and alone and kind of hopeless. So imagine the mechanics of Dark Souls all of a sudden turning into those of Bayonetta. And I think this was in an extra credits video. So Bayonetta is a very flashy game, lots of shooting and crazy stuff happening all the time. It's not very scary. You don't really feel alone. And all of a sudden, the narrative of Dark Souls no longer makes sense because the mechanics don't match up to the feelings that they want to elicit anymore. So that's just kind of a quick example to illustrate the importance of mechanics matching up to your narrative.
And to that end, I just want to make one quick distinction between narrative design and writing.
Yes, this is a good one.
Because writing is just referencing the actual written text and just the written dialogue, the screenplay, the summary of the story of the game.
Yeah.
Well, the narrative is much more holistic and looking at like, okay, well, this character kind of looks like a crazy person, so I'm going to write accordingly, or this whole world looks kind of decrepit, so the story is going to take kind of a more somber tone. And again, just trying to address the game in a more holistic manner than instead of just writing a screenplay and then saying, hey, make this into a game. Which yeah. We have met lots of writers like that in the industry.
It's true. So yeah, I think, and keep in mind as well, the title of narrative designer and writer will differ between every studio, and they will all have different meanings connotated with them, right? It's not about, if you're a narrative designer, that means you're responsible for kind of the approach to the game as a whole. That's not always true. You could just be considered, you know, somebody writing item descriptions and your job title is narrative designer, right? It's going to differ between places, but broadly speaking, for the purposes of this episode, it's exactly what Aiden said. Narrative design, it's a holistic approach to the game, taking into account a marriage of mechanics and gameplay, and writing is just kind of the basic level of, okay, you have a character, write some dialogue.
So let's just take a step back for a second and talk about the three key elements of game writing. Plot, easy one. Character, people who do stuff in the plot, and lore, everything else.
Everything else, sure.
Which sounds like a much broader category, but let's just refer to it as like world building for now. Everything that kind of supplements the characters and the plot and make the world feel alive and present with or without you.
Totally.
Let's dissect these things one by one. Plot may seem very simple on the surface, but it does actually take a little bit to make a plot work.
Yeah.
Is at the very least, your plot is going to have to be original in some capacity. Otherwise, you fall into cliche and players are just going to mash the skip cutscene button and they're not going to be engaged with it. And the mechanics are just going to overwhelm your narrative.
Yeah.
This can also be fulfilled in the form of the game having a twist to it, a la Bioshock. Just some kind of dramatic twist that the players don't see coming, or mm-hmm. a dramatic reveal that kind of keeps the players hooked. Or if you want to go really down the rabbit hole, the game is a form of social commentary.
Absolutely.
It's trying to make a point.
Yeah, so I think as long as your plot has one of these three aspects, either originality, a twist, or some sort of social commentary, or perhaps a mix of all three, who knows?
Very ambitious.
it makes it something that will engage your players because they've never seen it before, they're interested in knowing what's happening, or they're extremely tied to the kind of social commentary that you're trying to say.
Characters are tricky, especially for the playable character.
Yeah.
Because if the player's playable characters' goals don't align with the characters, or if the actions that are available to the player or character don't align, there will be dissonance. And when we say dissonance, that means there's a disconnect between the player and the game.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think this is most common for role-playing games where there's a branching narrative that's occurring, because a lot of the time the players are encouraged to make their own choices to shape the story. But like Aiden said, if all of a sudden two choices are presented to you or more, and you're thinking, well, I don't think my character would choose any of these things, then all of a sudden narrative dissonance comes
up. You feel like you're no longer playing your character. Yeah. You're just along for the ride.
Exactly. And we're not saying that you should be able to create characters where players can't relate to them at all. I think that's an extremely important thing to have, to be able to share with people characters that maybe aren't as relatable. Maybe they're not the good guy or something like that. We're just talking about having a lot of choices presented to the player and them not feeling like their character would do any of them.
The characters, player playable or not, must be in sync with their art style.
Yes.
That if you've got this crazy straight edge guy and all of a sudden he has a pink mohawk, it's like, wait, what? And the characters have to themselves be designed in a holistic manner that goes with the narrative. So the narrative design of the character can inform the visual design or vice versa.
Absolutely. So I think a really common example of this is when you have typically a female character and she's very strong. She is, you know, kind of taking charge. She's possibly in a battle scenario and she's wearing, you know, bikini armor. She's got like a bra on or her panties are showing. That doesn't really make sense with who the character is or even what they're doing.
And
thus dissonance is achieved. So that's just something to watch out for in the aesthetic design of your characters. The lore of a game is important in terms of not only what the player might see, but what the player might not see. So a lot of the times, lore is the stuff that goes on behind the scenes of building up the world of the game to share with the team that is developing it. This provides the groundwork for everything that comes afterwards. So you can have pages and pages of history on your characters, on the world, on maybe like a war that's going on, and none of that might see the light of day in the game. But it's something that's important for everyone on the team to know in case they're drawing from something that they maybe want to add in. Like, let's say a house was burned down. While the player may not know, you know, the pages of history that led to that house being burned down, but you may have drawn inspiration from, I don't know, the war that was raging on, and the reason the house was burned down was because a family was fleeing from this conflict. And all the player needs to know is that there was a conflict, and that ends up tying into the rest of the world somehow. They don't need to know all that stuff, but it's really important for maybe your team to know that stuff, because it helps to keep everyone on the same page.
Now, looking at these three pillars, it's interesting to see how games choose to balance these. Because I think they all have to be present in some capacity, but in varying amounts. I think there's some games that can terrifically excel at all three, games like The Witcher, and some games that really only excel at two, or none, or one or zero. And when I say zero, it's usually because it's a bad game, not because it's something really bold.
Yes, yeah. I think when you're designing a game, it's important to recognize these pillars and decide, okay, this is going to be a character-focused game. We don't need to worry about the plot so much. And when I say you don't need to worry about the plot so much, I mean you could have a very generic plot. And this is something Final Fantasy is kind of known for, where there's a bad guy and you need to fight the bad guy. And that's kind of, you know, that's basically what's going on.
Easy. Hero's journey. Done.
Yeah, exactly.
Call it a day.
What's interesting about the Final Fantasy games and what makes them so lovable is not the plot. It's the characters that are experiencing the plot. And so I think Final Fantasy really understands that that is what makes it unique and special. And that's why the characters are so special. So when you're designing a game, don't worry about including all three of these things. Just recognize what you want your game to be, and then plan accordingly for which pillar you kind of want to build up the most or be the focus of the story.
And we'll get more into that when we start to address types of plot structure. But before we get into that, let's talk about modes of delivery.
How do
you deliver these things to the player, shall we?
Yeah, how does story get into the game?
Let's just spitball here. How have these kind of things been delivered to you in video games?
Well, the big one I can think of is cutscenes. We all know cutscenes.
In-game dialogue, things that aren't in cutscenes, but just people talking to each other.
Yep.
People speaking at you over phone calls, where they're not on screen, is a big one these days. Mm-hmm. Or spoken over intercom, think like Portal, where GLaDOS is just kind of always talking to you from any given direction.
Yep.
Video diaries and audio diaries, or regular diaries for that matter, like books, where just the player just goes and picks up these things and it fills in a bit of the backstory.
Yep, that's a good one.
Anything put on the loading screens, often things like item descriptions.
Yeah, Bloodborne, the Dark Souls series is huge for loading screens and delivering what we were talking about before, lore, through a lot of their loading screens. Very rich lore, which they're delivering to their players. There's also, of course, gameplay, which we were talking about. Gameplay is a great way to deliver story, whether that's through a mechanic, like the way your character jumps. Maybe that's an integral part to their character, and that could be, you know, tied to the narrative, of course. There's also environmental storytelling, which is really big. Doom is actually really good for this. Doom 2016, a lot of the time you'll find a character, or I guess like I guess one of the workers on the Mars unit or whatever, and they'll have been killed in a violent way, and you have to, like, go rip their arm off. But, of course, you can, like, see this dead body and be like, ah, I can probably guess as to how they were killed. So that's just, yeah, an example of that.
And then things like character design and then the people who voice the characters, specifically with things like their accents and stuff and what that implies about
them. Yeah, accents are huge. I think we're going to do, we might end up doing a future episode on this, but just a quick example is when you're in a fantasy world and your character is speaking with an American accent, all the other characters you speak to who have an American accent, you're going to assume they are from a similar place where you are from. So this kind of gives insights into who you may be speaking to, if you're speaking to someone with similar goals as yourself, stuff like that. And that can fall apart when the accents aren't correct, because then it's an assumed likeness when perhaps there isn't one, but we'll get into that in a later episode.
So the one I wanted to highlight really quick is the phone calls or being spoken at over an intercom, where basically the player character is having a conversation or being spoken at by someone who is not on screen.
Yeah.
So the game is still happening around the player. This is not being interrupted at all while the story is being told. So Yuri Hornman, who's a game developer, gave a presentation on narrative design at GDC a few years ago, called these techniques cliched. And I think to an extent they are, but I think they're cliched because they're very effective. Because we've kind of alluded to this already, but a narrative is often kind of in conflict with its mechanics if it's not done well, or even if it is done well, that some players just want to play the game. They're not here for a story, and having the phone calls or the dialogue over the gameplay is an effective way to kind of have the best of both worlds. That the story is being told without intruding on the gameplay.
Yeah, so I think it's our job as designers, when cliches start happening, you start hearing too many phone calls while you're playing or finding too many diaries full of, you know, descriptions of the world. I think it's our job as designers to innovate on that and find new ways to tell the story. And I don't have the answers for that right now, but I think it's something to definitely think about.
So yes, cliched but effective. Probably should find a new solution at some point.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk plot.
Yeah, so this is going to be the bulk of the rest of the episode, which we are really interested in exploring here. So plot is going to be the focus.
And again, we could do entire episodes on lore and character as well, but I think
plot
is one of the more fundamental aspects of narrative, in my opinion.
Yes, so we may come back with another episode on how to write more specifically a game sort of section, or write good characters, all that good stuff. But let's get to plot for now.
All right, so let's talk plot.
Yeah, so there are three kinds of plot that are very well known, and then a fourth one that we've added in ourselves. So,
as professional academics.
Oh, you know it. So here are the four kinds we'll be talking about. Linear, arborescent, bottleneck, and our own special kind, singular or contextual. So let's start off with linear. What is a linear plot, Aiden?
Linear is easy. It is the exact same as a movie. The narrative, the plot has no branches to it. We just go from point A to point B. There's no chance for the player to say, I want to go left when the plot wants to go right.
Yes, very much so. So examples of these are Uncharted or Tomb Raider. The player has no agency. They're very much just following the character along for the ride. And this doesn't mean that there can't be side quests that the player might be able to go on, but it's not going to have an overarching impact on the narrative. So I like to think of Borderlands 2, for example, like this. Right. There's tons of side quests you can do, but the
side quests themselves are in their own way linear.
Yes, exactly. That's what I was... Yes. They're very linear in themselves, where you can sort of like branch off for a second and be like, okay, that was fun, but then you're always going to be returning to the main plot, which you have no influence over.
So the pros of linear is you get lots of control over the narrative as a designer. You are just the writer, you sculpt the world, what you say goes.
Yes.
But the cons is that you're going to get some ludonarrative dissonance. I'm going to say that again because it's a stupidly long term. Ludonarrative dissonance.
What is that?
It is when there is disconnect between what is happening in the plot and what is happening in the game.
Absolutely. So I think the best example of this is the Uncharted games where...
Man, poor Uncharted, getting beat up today.
I know, I feel bad. I'm sorry, Uncharted. But it's the idea of where Nathan Drake is the protagonist... is the protagonist of this game, and he's made out in cutscenes to be a very nice guy. He's very caring. He's very charismatic, all this good stuff. But in the gameplay, the linear gameplay of the game, he's killed thousands of people. And so there's sort of a... I think this is addressed in one of the later games, but this does create that ludonarrative dissonance where you're playing this really charming, charismatic, like, lovely person, and then you're, like, a mass murderer, and it's like, okay, something isn't quite lining up. So that can kind of be a problem that comes up with linear narratives like that.
And again, like, so the when we say that when a linear narrative just doesn't offer any player agency, giving the player agency in the narrative kind of lets them get around the ludonarrative dissonance a bit, because it lets them behave in a way that is more according to the world they want to be in.
Yeah.
Like, for instance, if all of a sudden you could change the narrative so Nathan Drake just didn't kill anyone and just surrendered to anyone who tried to shoot him, mm-hmm. and let that also be a game, it would be a dramatic departure and the game would no longer be linear, but there'd be less pseudo-narrative dissonance.
Yeah, it's like how Dishonored works with having the mechanics of you can kill a lot of people or you can use stealth mode and not kill a lot of people, and that'll have influence over your ending. That is less ludonarrative dissonance because the player can very much choose, do I want to be a killer, do I not want to be a killer, and I will see those repercussions of my actions later.
Right, so the next one is arborescent, which is essentially when every choice leads to another choice, and every choice that you come to down any given path cannot be reached from a different path made earlier. It's like a tree branch branching out in different directions, and the branches never reconverge.
Yes.
So the pros for this is that there's a lot of choice.
Oh yeah.
That anything you say goes, and you can end up down all kinds of different crazy rabbit holes. And you are going to have perfect ludonarrative dissonance. The player cannot complain about anything that happens in the game because they are in complete control. Now, there's kind of a con to this.
Oh, yes. It's impossible.
Yes. Essentially, the second the game becomes anything more than a text-based adventure, it is far too much work to do on a big scale.
The amount of options that begin to pile up on one another, it ends up being millions in the millions of outcomes because it expands exponentially, and then that's just too much for anybody to work around. So the game example we kind of struggled to come up with, a lot of hypertext games actually do come up with this. We don't have an example of one, but it's just because it's easier in order to type things out rather than, you know, animate full scenes with these outcomes. But we did think of one, so the Stanley Parable is a good example of an arborescent game where there are many paths. It's short, which is good, which I think is why it's possible, but there are many different paths that you can take, and they all lead to very different outcomes.
Yeah, because the game is like less than 5 minutes long per playthrough, if you know where you're going, which is the only way it's feasible, because that's only like 5 minutes times 20 different endings is only 100 minutes of gameplay. But if you have 30 hours of gameplay and it's all, and you have 16 different endings that are all arborescent, well, that's going to multiply that unbelievably.
Yes.
It's going to be far too much work to feasibly pull off.
Yeah, and it's going to be a lot of work for a little payoff because a lot of the players are going to miss a lot of the content that you've worked so hard to create. Which isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's just something to keep in mind if you want to kill yourself over making a 60-hour, you know, arborescent experience. That's all we're saying.
Bottleneck is kind of the happy medium between linear and arborescent structures, where the game plot will branch out into different directions based on player choices, but eventually reconverge back onto linear path. So you ask the player, do you want to go in the left door or the right door? They pick one, but they'll eventually end up back in the same room.
Yes, so the amount of choice you have is actually more limited than you think it is. And the concept that is kind of brought up around this idea is illusory agency. So illusory agency is when you think you have more agency than you actually do.
You think you're all clever going through the left door and you're like, man, no one else went through the left door. I'm going somewhere special, but no.
Yeah, and I think this is more apparent in games that you've only played once because you make some choices and you think it was because I made those choices that I ended up here. But really, if you played the game again and took the other path, you would probably notice that you end up in a very similar position.
For me, this has always been embodied by the Telltale games where they always are like making notes in the top right saying, this person remember this or you did this. And it's like, it's trying to basically say like, we as the game designers have flagged your action and it will be coming into account in the future of the narrative.
Yes.
Which is almost never true.
Yeah.
They are flagging very few things.
There's also less ludonarrative dissonance because the player is making choices for themselves that they might make personally.
As opposed to linear where there was none and arborescent where there was infinite, this is just kind of the happy medium between the two where there is some.
Yes.
And this basically ensures that players will have similar experiences with their games and still see most of the content you put out while still having some player agency.
So the cons are that players can often feel cheated as some of their choices wind up being meaningless.
I feel like there's an example of this that is very famous
from 2012. For sure. So it's tough to talk about bottlenecking without bringing up Mass Effect 3. So the Mass Effect series is much beloved. Mass Effect 2 is hailed as one of the greatest video games of all time. Mass Effect 3, however, is extremely controversial. So the game ending basically has Shepard, the main character, confronted with three choices. And no matter which choice you make, you basically get the same ending, just in a different, I don't know, Instagram filter.
We're being a bit hyperbolic here, but essentially this is a series that prided itself on having important and meaningful consequences for its players' actions, ultimately have its ending reduced to three choices. It's a really, really harsh bottleneck given the scope of the series.
Yeah, so you can imagine why players felt cheated, because up to the ending, the game communicated that they had agency and that their choices mattered. And then all of a sudden, that was entirely subverted at the end, where you choose something and it really doesn't matter which one you chose. It's pretty similar. This is also an interesting example of mechanics versus narrative, which we were touching on in the beginning as well. So the importance of having your mechanics blend with your narrative. So the mechanics in this sense was bottlenecking, and this idea that, yes, you can make choices, and sometimes, yeah, they are going to have a huge impact on the game. Basically communicating to the player that choices matter. But the narrative, on the other hand, of Mass Effect 3 is very much about sacrifice, about self-sacrifice, about loss. That was a huge thing as well. So I actually think, from a narrative perspective, the ending of Mass Effect 3 made sense, where Shepard had to die, even though there's one ending out of like 9 where like she doesn't. But it's this idea that the narrative was leading toward one thing of loss and, you know, the Reapers taking over the world, but then being opposed to the mechanics, which said, you know, you'll be able to choose your ending. So I think that's just kind of relating to what we were talking about at the beginning. All right, so moving on to singular or contextual.
So this is where the narrative doesn't actually have plot points. Nothing really changes, the plot doesn't really advance, everything kind of just remains at the status quo. Which sounds like a strange thing to describe as a plot structure, but it is one that actually exists.
Yes.
So consider this is typically manifests itself in multiplayer games, like Overwatch or League of Legends or MMOs like World of Warcraft, where the characters are all just kind of stagnant, and the world is stagnant. They just kind of exist to serve as context for what is happening in the game, but nothing really happens to them.
Yeah, because it would be strange. So for Overwatch, for example, you can't kill Tracer. You know what I mean?
Well, you can't.
Well, I mean, you can, of course, you can kill her. But in the lore of the, like, the behind the scenes of the game, like, you can't kill her off in one of those cutscenes that they release, because then you wouldn't be able to play her in the game, and that defeats the purpose of creating heroes.
And there are people
heroes.
Who, like, dedicate their, like, shooting careers to mastering how to play Tracer. You can't just siphon that out. The game is just kind of stuck.
Yeah, so it creates not only, like, a stagnant environment where nothing really changes, because it does happen, you know, outside the game, but it also creates a lack of stakes. You're not ever worried about, you know, Tracer dying or like her state of mind or anything like that. She's always gonna have the same voice lines. She's always gonna be there, which I think is fine, because it is, you know, a bigger game. You know, it's an online shooter, which is a lot of fun. But that is something to keep in mind.
And if we take this back to the three pillars of game writing, of character lore and plot, this is just taking the plot out of it, and we're putting all the emphasis on character and lore, and it completely works.
Yeah, very much so.
But again, it's a singular node. It does not branch anywhere. There's no choice. It doesn't. Nothing will ever.
There's no progression.
And that's what makes it unique.
Except for the characters. The characters, I guess, can progress when you have like those little videos that come out, kind of sharing a little bit more of their backstory. I think you get to learn a little bit more about them, but it doesn't advance anything.
I think
in
that's
any way.
More servicing the lore than actually advancing a plot.
Yes. Well, like, yeah, it doesn't advance the plot at all. But I guess you have a better understanding of the characters.
Yes. So in our handy textbook that we always reference for these episodes, The Art of Game Design by Jesse Schell, Jesse made an interesting case about multiple endings and player agency in video games. Do you want to go into that?
Yeah, so in The Art of Game Design textbook, Jesse Schell, basically he makes the argument that it's not great to have multiple endings because players will want the real ending. They'll be frustrated when they don't get the real ending. They'll have an idea in their head of what the real ending is, or perhaps by looking it up online and seeing what everyone else thinks is the real ending, and they'll feel cheated if they don't get this ending. So we disagree with this logic. We don't think that endings are any real or not real than other ones. I think how to combat this idea is just by creating a game that doesn't have black and white morality, basically. There's no one ending that is good. There's no one ending that is bad. It's just sort of the choices that you've made to get to that point. And then when you get the ending, you should be satisfied with that ending because it was you who got yourself there. And those choices that you were making to the best of your ability were the ones that led you to kind of the outcome that you were heading to the entire time. And so we think that if the game is designed in a way that will allow you to act in rational ways that make sense to you, that the ending you get, you'll probably be okay with. I think a great example of this is The Witcher 3 Wild Hunt. where there are two endings. There are many endings, keep that in mind, but there are two main endings that players are kind of always talking about, whether it's which one is the better one.
Yeah.
And so I'll quickly, spoiler alert if you haven't played the ending in The Witcher, but basically there's two endings where Ciri, Geralt's, the main character's adopted daughter, can either end up as an empress or she'll be training as a witcher. And so this is kind of a contested issue, which I think is really great, an example of good narrative design, because players can't really agree which ending is better, which I think is the way it should be. There should be no best ending. It should just be whatever you're passionate about, whatever led you to that point. That's great. That's your ending, and you should be happy, or at least you have the ability to be content with that without wanting another one.
Like, consider the alternative. Like, let's just say the two binary endings where Ciri lives and Ciri dies.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like most of us, even whether or not how much we're buying into the game lore at all, realize that the goal of the game was to save and protect Ciri. And
yeah.
We would all kind of acknowledge that that was the good ending.
Yes.
Was the one where you saved Ciri.
Totally, totally.
Which is a lot less interesting.
Yes. There's also the argument made by Jesse Schell that in narratives, a lot of the stakes are removed, especially in non-linear narratives like Bottlenecks and Arborescent, where you have choices. The stakes are removed because you can simply reload the game. If something happens that you don't like, you can just reload, and good to go.
To which he concludes that there's just no point in bothering.
Yeah, there's no point in bothering.
Now, this is where we kind of started to realize this textbook may be a little bit dated in its
yes.
views. This textbook came about 10 years ago, and I feel like that's definitely a view that's no longer as embraced by the gaming industry.
Yeah. So we've kind of come up with some things that can be done to keep players committed to their decisions, to
Despite the reload function.
Despite the reload function, to keep players from not reloading, to stick to their decisions and play the game the way that they want to play it without worrying whether they did the right thing or not.
So one extreme is just you can't undo narrative decisions at all.
Yeah, just program it into the game. You can't reload.
There's actually very few examples of this because players like being able to go back and
yes.
replay the game.
Even
and
I do.
And try different things and play earlier saves, or at the very least, like, restart the game. So the only example I was able to find was this kind of interesting game that you can play online called One Chance. And it's a Flash game that you only get one playthrough, because the game will make a cookie on your browser that says you played the game already, you can't restart. You get one playthrough, no do-overs. And honestly, I found that game very profound. And I would recommend anyone give it a quick play. But again, I don't think it's practical. Like, imagine if you signed up to play The Witcher 3 and you finished your playthrough and you just couldn't restart. You were stuck in the endgame now.
Yeah, well, also there's, you know, reloading is really useful to get around things like bugs and when your character, like, phases through the wall and,
yeah.
like, sometimes you just have to reload.
Yeah. So that's the problem with this method, is that it's just way too harsh on yeah. What any game it has to be.
All right, so another solution is having repercussions that do not become apparent for several hours. So players, in order to kind of reload their last decision, they would have to replay those several hours of content. And so...
So it's almost like a penalty for reloading.
Yeah,
but it's an organic
exactly.
one that's built into the game.
But I think not only is it a penalty, but it's not meant to be a penalty. It's meant to be a choice that you make that is not apparent. And it's like, well, I guess I couldn't have seen that coming, but, you know, I was satisfied with the choice I made then, and I guess I'll be okay with the consequence, because in that moment, the choice I was making made sense to me. And so I think Witcher 3, again, is a great example of this, where a lot of the choices you make, the consequences aren't going to be apparent for a very long time, or you may not even realize that choice you made actually led to that outcome. And I think this is actually a really great way to let players be comfortable with the choices that they have, because they don't necessarily know how it's going to affect the world. They're just doing what they think is logical and right in that moment. And I think that helps people be okay.
Being comfortable sitting there and saying, things didn't go well, but I did the best I could.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
No, and this is kind of a tangent of that, but the consequences aren't black and white. And this is less important whether it's immediate or not. It doesn't really matter how long the repercussions take to become apparent. It's just that whether you go in the left or the right door isn't black or white, good or evil. This kind of runs contrary to what you see in a lot of games these days. Like, the Infamous games, for example, for me, were really weird. These were games that employed a really, really harsh morality system, whether you wanted to be a hero or an anti-hero, and every action you could take in the game was binary. And what really sucked was that the game rewarded you really committing to one side. So when the game stopped at a story juncture and asked you whether you wanted to make the good decision or the anti-hero decision, it really just rewarded you for just sticking to the one you made earlier on. It's not really asking you a question. Like, you could play the middle of the road path, but there's no real incentive to do that from a gameplay perspective. And I think what's being reflected there is a poor mesh of mechanics and narrative.
Yeah, so Mass Effect, again, is a good example of this. Mass Effect is really known for their morality system of Paragon versus Renegade, good versus evil. Binary. Similarly binary. In the first two Mass Effect games, this was the system they employed. In order to get special dialogue or scenes to play out the way you want them, you had to commit entirely to Paragon or Renegade, and it stopped being about what the player would choose and more about gaming the system in order to get all the points you needed, fully committing to Paragon, fully committing to Renegade in order to get those outcomes. So it very much became a linear experience because you're no longer making choices. You're making choices that you know will get you enough points. So they actually changed this system in Mass Effect 3. It became more about reputation points. So you could choose whatever you wanted and it wouldn't feed into either being Renegade, like bad or good. It would just feed into you getting points, making decisions. So it allowed you to play kind of more in the middle, in that gray area where sometimes, you know what, you're the good guy. Sometimes you got to make tough decisions and be the bad guy, and that's okay. So I think that's a good example of a studio recognizing that this system wasn't the best for making interesting narratives and for actually really feeding into that player agency. And yeah, they made a change for the better, I think.
And returning from that tangent for a moment, we have one more solution to keeping players committed to their decisions.
Yes.
And that is making the game knows you reloaded.
Exactly.
And reflects as such.
Yeah. So basically, your game becomes sentient. You have to, like, train it like a dog for a couple days, you know, be nice to it, talk nicely, and then it'll just be able to
know. Then it becomes HAL 9000.
Yeah, exactly. And then it just, yeah, gains sentience, starts walking around. It's a good time.
So this is a really tricky one because it has to make sense in the context of the game. The narrative kind of has to be a little bit meta.
Yeah. So the game
is acknowledging that it's a game.
Yeah, exactly. That too. They're like, oh, you reloaded. What are you doing? So Undertale, of course, is a great example of this. Undertale is very meta. It gets into a lot of stuff. If you haven't played it, would highly recommend. But this is an example where, yeah, let's say you make a decision and you're like, oh my gosh, I didn't mean to do that. And you exit out of the game and reload. The game will literally be like,
nope.
Or no, it won't say no. It'll say like, I see that you reloaded. Like, we're going to remember that you did that.
Or, like, if you reach a certain ending, some endings in the game will actually, like, taint your save forever. And every time you try a new playthrough, it's going to be tainted.
Yeah.
And the game knows that you did that evil ending or you did that one ending or whatever.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. But, again, that works within the game, right? So I think when you're designing a game, it's important to keep in mind what kind of game you're creating and what sort of solutions you can come up with to keep players committed to their decisions. Don't be afraid to think outside of the box. Get weird. Get, you know, kind of quirky. Think of things that people haven't thought of yet, which I know is a crazy statement, but, you know, just do it. It's all good.
But yeah, for this section, just remember, I would just focus on the prior two, that the repercussions either aren't apparent for a while, or the repercussions aren't black and white in their good or evil nature.
Yeah,
Those are the main two keys to keeping your players happy with their decisions and not constantly reloading. Although if they're constantly reloading, I guess that shows that they care about the plot in their own way.
Exactly, yeah.
So it's kind of a win.
Yeah.
All right, want to move into takeaways?
Yeah.
All right, so narrative is more than just writing. And it has to have a holistic role in the game. And as developers, I think it has to have a holistic role in all parts of game development. There's just kind of this cliche in the industry that writers don't come on too late in the project. And I think that is often a reason why there is kind of this often outsider view that games don't have good writing.
We also talked about bottlenecking a lot in this episode. I think it's important to recognize that it isn't good or bad. It's kind of whatever you make of it. And it is one of the best ways currently to represent player agency in a narrative when you have choices presented. And so just take into account things you can do to make players invested in the narrative that they are telling by making their choices. And just try not to cheat your players at the end.
And finally, morality systems, especially just the black and white ones that have like tangible player available meters that say how good or evil you are, mm-hmm. I don't think they play a good role. I think they're a bad, lazy game design.
Yeah, I think too with morality systems, I'll go a little easier on them. I think that if they fit into the theme of your game for what you're trying to say, the story you were trying to tell, then go for it. I still think there are interesting things to be done with it. But once again, what we've been sort of stressing this entire time, take a look at your game as a whole and see if it fits into the message you're trying to say, the theme, the mechanics of what you want the game to be, what you want players to take away from your game. If it fits into that and you feel like it is, you know, right for the story that you're telling, then go for it. Just keep your players engaged and
make sure the game mechanics complement the narrative as best it can.
Yeah. But yeah, we love narrative, so let us know, as always.
And we'll see you next time.
All right, so for the sign-off today, the textbook that Jesse Schell is writing, The Art of Game Design, actually poses the question, why don't video games make us cry? And I think this is a very silly question because I cry at video games all the time.
It's true.
It's very true. Aiden can support me on this one.
The real question you should be asking is, how do video games make us not cry?
Exactly. I think that's a much better question. But basically, he's making the argument that because when you watch a movie or you read a book, you're sort of just hurtling towards whatever the character is going towards. Like, there's nothing you can really do to prevent it. And so he says, and this is quoting him, this rush of being carried along toward certain doom is something that video game stories simply cannot support. For instance, if every protagonist has a time machine, and anything seriously bad that happens can always be undone. So I think this is very silly, because games like Ori and the Blind Forest and Life is Strange, they have emotional moments that are emotional no matter how many times you try to rewind them or replay them. So Ori and the Blind Forest is linear, and I think it has these really impactful moments that even if you, you know, save the game, walk away for a little while, they're going to stay with you. It has a really impactful story.
And like his argument saying it's like, well, you can just undo bad things that happen. It's like, well, for linear games, that means you're just rewinding the plot. It's like rewinding a movie.
It's
the argument
no
doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I think he just wasn't taking into consideration the emotional impact that video games have on people generally. And I think that if people are rewinding or, you know, reloading their saves, it's not because they don't care about the game. It's because they are being emotionally impacted by what's happening and they want to rewind to get something better or to have their characters live or something like that, right? There's an emotional connection there. And I think he kind of missed the point on that one. Mm-hmm. I mean,
You defended your case on why it's okay to cry in video games.
Yes, exactly. So everyone go pick up a video game, have a good cry. It's good for the soul. I would highly recommend.
Thanks for listening. You can reach us on social media at panicmode.net, all spelled out, or on our website, panicmode.net. We'd love to hear any comments, questions, or feedback you have about today's episode. We're very new at podcasting. We'd love to hear what you have to say. We'll be back next time to talk about positive and negative feedback in game design. We'll see you then.